Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's occasional lecture. It's a great pleasure for me today to welcome Dr. David Burchell from the University of Western Sydney today. In the midst of our own election campaign, some of us may have forgotten that only a couple of months ago, the British were in the grips of one of their most fascinating campaigns for some time, which resulted in a change of government, a new coalition government, and all sorts of interesting things. So it's about things in Britain, how not to do it, lessons for Australia, that Dr. David Burchell is going to talk to us today, and I invite you to welcome him to the podium. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. Is this okay, the sound? Yeah? Good. I'm going to get a strip to my normal combat dress in the lecturing, talking mode. I'll have to pardon me for a second. And I should confess right from the outset that what I've done here is slightly self-indulgent, which is my normal manner of doing these things. I've taken this as a slight occasion to be slightly more literary and reflective than an academic is supposed to be, which is my natural way of being anyway, so that's all good for me. Whether you like it is another question altogether. Yeah. Okay, so I slightly amended the title for my purposes, Reflections on the 2010 UK elections. I'm not proposing to offer a definitive analysis of what went right and what went wrong with them, but I'm going to talk about them, offer some personal reflections and reminiscences relating to them and other UK elections, and sum up with some thoughts for us in Australia as well, while trying to keep that at a level which I hope is useful without you know, being polemical or partisan or all of the things that really seem to be not appropriate for this venue. Okay, so I should confess from the outset, I've said here that here I'm involved in something of a reverie, and I might as well get this out of the way right from the start. A fraction more than a quarter of a century ago, when I was a nervous young doctoral student, and some part of me probably still is, I voyaged to Britain for the first time to carry out my program of research in the dusty paper archives of that era, sort of long since lost, unfortunately, in the move towards digitalness. It was a different Britain to the one you'll experience as a tourist today, even only a quarter of a century ago. In the first 6 months I was there, I lodged as a visitor in graduate accommodation at one of the old Cambridge colleges, an experience which at that time was still akin to being returned by time machine to the middle decades of the 19th century, possibly as a theology student. The male students still wore candy striped shirts and pastel pullovers in the Bride's Head Revisited style. I'm talking about the 1980s here. And their skin had a pale apricot hue, like that of a healthy, well-fed infant. The female students, I well remember, dressed with arch conservativeness, were as cool as ice and averted their eyes as they spoke. A good many of the students still possessed what the Welsh cultural studies professor Raymond Williams once referred to a little cruelly as the English upper-class speech impediment. You know what I mean. A cultivated affliction which gives its sufferers the appearance of children with a bad lisp. People still drank something called Pym's Number One Cup on the college lawns, and they played social cricket matches with the consumptive languor of romantic poets. And I do recall, as a young Australian at that point, having a reddish-hued beard. My slow, medium-paced bowling filmed them with terror. They thought I must be Dennis Lilly and tried to fend off bounces that never came. Pretty soon I found myself gravitating, as I imagine other Australians might have done too, towards the plentiful American exchange students at that college, which had been the alma mater of John Harvard many centuries before. And they seemed more familiar in their general egalitarian temper, as well as in their consciousness of being treated as colonials, even after the short space of 200 years. Another familiar thing to other Australians who visited, I'm sure. In the second six months of my visit there, and we're talking the year 1984 into 1985, after a youthful romantic catastrophe from which I'll spare you the details, I lived a quite different life in a rented flat in the Tower Block Council Estate Badlands of southeast London, where there were places called Katfa, which we'd call Catford, and Lewisham, which we would call Lewisham. In those far-off days, there were only two or three culinary options in those parts of London. You could order oily plaice and chips with mushy peas, and a scalding cup of tea bag tea at the local chippy. You could buy jellied eel. You could still buy jellied eel in a paper packet from a corner kiosk that seemed not to have been scrubbed since the Georgian era. Or you could order takeaway chicken vindaloo from one of the brand new microscopic Indian diners spreading like a benign species of reverse colonialism across the land. In that part of London, black folks still drank in the back bar universally and white folks in the front bar, while white men over 50, even as young as that, still wore flat caps, had bad teeth with nicotine stains, and bantered cheerfully in a local dialect that elided the final consonants of every word. On local Saturday afternoons, the football fans still indulged in the traditional English urban recreation of rioting. They burned down a large part of Millwall football ground while I was living within a kilometre of it. There was another curious symmetry about my hectic year of research, life discovery and romantic disaster. Shortly before I boarded the plane from Sydney, the leader of Britain's National Union of Miners, Arthur Scargill, summarily and without bothering to ballot his members, declared an indefinite strike on the nation's coal fields. At the end of winter, when the peak consumer demand for coal was already past and with the nation's coal stocks boosted to record levels by the wily manager of the nation's coal board in anticipation of just such an event. The strike was called off with the rump of the union industrially broken, financially bankrupt, but emotionally unbowed, within days of my return, as a result of which, to me personally, the entire year, the miners' strike year, still has a strange, unworldly character, as if I'd voyaged for another year to a fabulous, distant world where different rules of logic and gravity applied, rather like a medieval fantasy travel writer like Sir John Mandeville, if you've ever tried to read him. Labour historians of a romantic bent in the best quixotic traditions of their trade have written up that catastrophic year in the history of the British Labour movement as if it were a paradoxical moral victory of some kind, much like Dunkirk or Rorke's Drift or the relief of Mafeking were written of as victories in patriotic history books a generation or two before. Or few before, and yet I think it's not inappropriate, and I hope I'm not being too blindly patriotic in saying this, to suggest that the Great British Miners' Strike of that year, an event which lasted for a full year, bankrupted and broke the union, ruined the finances of thousands of families, destroyed interpersonal relations in dozens of communities, killed several people, and in the end achieved more or less nothing, is exactly the kind of event that distinguishes British political culture in its elemental aspects from our own. Political scientists sometimes like to distinguish between expressive and instrumental styles in politics, where the purpose of a political expression is to let out and demonstrate your feelings, even to strike a pose perhaps, while the purpose of a political instrument is to achieve a concrete goal, regardless of how mundane or unglamorous you appear in the process. If you constructed a graph line where the two poles were expression on one hand and instrumentality on the other, for all the other links between our nations, Britain's and Australia's political cultures, I think, would surely sit almost as far apart as is practically possible, or even geometrically possible, I suspect. We being, I think, crude instrumentalists, and they being romantic expressionists. To put the matter crudely, we would never have done things like that. It takes a special kind of national genius to get things that wrong. Indeed, if there's a single dominating image of that year still burning in my mind, after a quarter of a century, it's a Britain, for all its seeming modernity and contemporaneous, is still a conflicted 19th century romantic nation at heart, still trying itself in clever verbal knots, still deferring the inevitable, still tilting at windmills, still struggling in perplexity with the problem of democracy and its implications for the national culture, and still, in James Joyce's exquisite old phrase, gazing at itself, as he said, through the cracked looking glass of a servant. The other striking thing about the peculiar moment in British history is, for better or worse, and here the reverie is over, I'll get more to the point, that it launched almost all the trains of events I think we've seen in Britain over the course of the last few months and years, into the station, as it were, if you had trains of events going into a station, more or less at the same time, all pulling into the station around about April this year when Britain had its general election. After all, if you go back to that period I'm reminiscing about, the early mid-1980s, it was the 1983 election which properly inaugurated the period, grandiosely titled Thatcherism by its critics, which first and most decisively remade modern British politics into what appeared for a good period of time to be a three-party system. Even though the great bulk of the British political establishment managed to ignore this obvious fact rather stoically, I think, for another generation. It was the same election that launched one of the Western world's more remarkable political experiments, during which the supervisors of one of the world's most extensive and comprehensive welfare states set out on the business of dismantling the structures they had been ostensibly elected to superintend. To many observers back at that time, it seemed as if the British Labour Party in particular was finished as a major political force. After 4 years of civil war in which obscure Trotskyist conventicles took part of a large number of Labour city organisations and the party's conference seemed to be engaged in an all-out war with its own parliamentary party, Labour's vote fell in 1983 to an extraordinary, unprecedented, unbelievable 27.6%, which is to say about 1.5% less than what it was this year. A disaster never equalled since the end of the First World War or since, although, as I just said, this year was very close, and in fact there was a long period in the British election campaign earlier this year when it seemed as if that record might be broken, in fact. In the end, though, Labour survived, thanks in large measure to the selfless and patient efforts of his then parliamentary leader, Neil Kinnock, perhaps was Britain's equivalent of Bill Hayden, I suppose, in putting a party back together after a disaster. And in the long run, 1983 was actually most notable for the collapse of the British electoral system as an adequate instrument for the transmission of popular votes into parliamentary representation. And this, I think, is the more significant thing in hindsight in terms of current events in Britain of that period, or at least the parliamentary politics of that period. Labour's 26.7 or so percent of the popular vote that year netted it no fewer than 209 seats in the House of Commons, a disastrous figure, but still far more than you might have expected, mainly due to the fortuitous concentration of Labour votes into strategic electoral heartlands. And yet the Liberal Social Democratic Alliance of that time, the forerunners of today's Liberal Democrats, secured a full quarter of the popular vote, about 2% less than Labour, and nevertheless were rewarded with 23 seats, which meant in effect that in 1983 a Labour voter's vote was worth on average about 10 times that of an Alliance or Liberal Democrat voter, a proportion that would seem ridiculous in Australia, and if it happened, obviously, we would think there was a problem. And I think it's fair to say, only could seem unremarkable and not a major fundamental political problem in a country such as Britain, which, even though it was the birthplace of modern democracy, was still allowing members of Parliament to voyage down to London with a few dozen votes in their pockets in the 19th century, or on a few occasions with no votes at all. I think history has to be at least one explanation of why the British electorate and the British political establishment is so tolerant of political outcomes that by our standards seem absurdly perverse. Of course, Britain is not just the mother of democracy, although of course Americans might contest that fact. They were more democratic at an earlier stage, as they like to point out. It's also the mother of the two-party institution, as a system, as an institution, as in a way of life. And all the folklore which created that in British history, in the epic, catastrophic, religious and political antagonisms of the 17th and 18th centuries. Of course, before the Labour and Conservative parties of today, there were the Conservative and Liberal parties, the Whigs and the Tories, Hanoverians and Jacobites, Roundheads and Cavaliers. Indeed, you could almost go so far as to style Britain the birthplace of the modern political binary opposition. In a sense, they kind of invented it, the idea that the political spectrum only works when it's divided into two warring groups who, in a sense, monopolise the political space. And so, in the early decades of the 20th century, when the morning star, as they used to like to call it, of the Labour movement seemed to be in ascendancy, the old Liberal Party, which traditionally had been the centre-left party in the way the spectrum was aligned in those days, more or less graciously consented to die, as if to allow the new party into being and to allow the two-party system to continue. And historians have often wondered about that peculiar event, why it was that so neatly a two-party system of Liberals and Conservatives morphed into a two-party system of Conservatives and Labour, as if the Liberals willingly consented to die, as if it seemed to be crucial to have two parties and no more and no fewer. Now, as it happens in the 1980s, there was for a while a lively enough debate about what was wrong with British political institutions at that time and the possibility of a three-party system emerging in the country, as it seemed at that time to be doing. Labour polling 27%, the then Alliance, subsequent Liberal Democrats were 25%, very, very similar to the votes, in fact, in 2010. In fact, if you look at the election results from 1983 and 2010, they are startlingly similar in all sorts of ways. Very weird, and hence, of course, the cause of my reverie. And you would expect, of course, that they should have had such a debate. After all, the Conservatives won a swingeing majority in 1983 on the basis of about 42% of the popular vote. They also won in 1987 and 1992 with an almost identical popular base each time, meaning that they dominated British politics for about a decade, even though three in five voters voted for centre-left parties, which, again, in this country, I would think we would normally assume was an aberration that maybe would happen, we'd like to happen once, but not continuously for a decade, and then not to allow to happen periodically, even semi-normally, for a generation, which is what appears to have happened, where election results in Britain have now serially fallen dramatically out of line with the popular vote. Okay, so that's the first part of my reflections leading up to the British election of this year. I think there's a history there, in a recent history in Britain, of a failure, to summarise here, the lecturer, a failure to come to grips with the development that in Australia would have seemed very obvious, which was that the traditional model of the two-party system was falling apart for reasons that still aren't clear, least of all to the British political class, and an inability to imagine where to go from there. And I suspect, therefore, that the problems of the 2010 election in Britain, where you had a similarly odd result and then a long period after the election, you'll be aware, where nothing really happened and no one knew what was really happening, was, in a sense, the long-delayed outcome of about a generation worth of prevarication and avoiding the question, that great British national disease, I guess you could say. One other feature of British public life that I want to mention, which seems to me pertinent and relevant to current events, and which always strikes British Australian observers there, I think, is that by our standards, at least today, the relatively low level of economic debate there, and indeed of bare economic literacy, even amongst supposedly informed members of the political class. Here, Paul Keating, of course, once quipped something to the general effect that Australians had been forced to turn ourselves into amateur economists because of the manner of our introduction into the global economy in the 1980s and 1990s. We'd all been forced to think like miniature economists, and we all, so he claimed, read the business pages, which probably isn't true because they're unbelievably boring, but we do think more economically than we probably once did. He might have added that we are compelled into the same role by the confluence of our high levels of home ownership and our predilection for variable interest rate mortgages, which mean that we get incredibly anxious about our entire assets in the world possibly disappearing down the drain on the basis of movements of interest rates, inflation and other factors. And he might have topped this off by pointing out, contrary to what a British visitor might expect, that many of our best practical economists live not in leafy neighbourhoods or chic inner city apartments, where their denizens are blissfully free to think post-materially, in fact, but in the highly geared outer suburbs of our major cities, where a percentage point or two either way on the cash rate can make the difference between a sleepless week of sleepless nights and a full restful 8 hours a night. Now, British citizens today are certainly more economically literate than they were a quarter century ago, when, as I well recall, the ceremony of opening a bank account still felt like it was a sacrament, best conducted especially by visiting graduate students in a borrowed tie and white shirt, the tie slightly raffishly askew in the Australian fashion, and when most householders' dreams did not extend in that country but beyond a pocket handkerchief back garden and three or four rooms in a Blitz-era duplex, as we'd call it. And as we know, in Britain they've also moved into the world of shares, investment, managed funds and all the rest of it, foreign holidays, pastel-coloured lounge suites and all the rest of what they do. And yet, I think it's still fair to say that the expectations based on public policy competence there are still lower than we would be inclined to tolerate. And the costing of public policies for the purposes of public debate there is now, in fact, a business best done by people other than government, such as the admirable Institute for Fiscal Studies there that produces studies and papers about it, which I think, in some respects, were the stars of the British election campaign of 2010. I'd recommend them to you for light reading, the publications of the Institute of Fiscal Studies. You'll find much more about the state of British governance out of those than you will about out of most more official products there. It was often claimed at the time that Margaret Thatcher's premiership from the end of the 70s through to the middle of the 90s overthrew this culture of benign fiscal vagueness, which I think has probably been traditional in Britain ever since the Second World War, when they were still using American dollars to build the welfare state in the late 1940s. Supposedly Thatcher threw that over in favour of a severe model of balanced budgets on the model of the household budget, according to which, as she liked to tell us, or them over there, running public deficits was akin to sending a family to the poorhouse. But like so many agreeable political myths, I think this one's endured so well because it pleases everybody. Mrs. Thatcher's supporters, who saw in it evidence of her revolutionariness, and her critics, who saw it as evidence of her heartlessness. And yet, I don't think subsequent scholarship has really borne it out. Mrs. Thatcher and the other conservatives of her era cut public services, of which she disapproved, and she privatised public utilities so as to introduce market forces into previously state monopolies. But the rationale for both of these actions was really political, much more than economic. It wasn't really, in the first instance, fiscal at all. Public spending as a percentage of GDP actually fell only quite modestly between 1979 and 1997 in the great maelstrom of the Thatcher years, and mostly that was in the course of 2 or 3 years in the mid-latter 1980s. And yet tax receipts fell by an equal or greater amount over the same period, mostly as a result of political tax cuts by Margaret Thatcher, in fact. And so the net fiscal position of the British state at the end of the long conservative hegemony was little different from the beginning, except that the total amount of spending was less. The fiscal position of the British state wasn't much stronger at the end than it was at the beginning, for all that cutting and selling off. Again, while the Blair-Brown administration of the last decade or so from 1997 was bitterly criticised from its left, not even from its left, as being far too modest in its public spending, we now know in retrospect that Britain's fiscal position was being allowed to grow steadily more parlous over the course of all of the last decade, really, from the early 2000s, so that after the world economic shocks of late 2008, Britain's public finances more or less collapsed within a matter of months. And as you may be aware from the papers, Britain is now more heavily indebted than it was at the end of the Second World War, believe it or not, and of all of the G7 countries, it has by some distance the largest structural component of its deficit of all, which makes it the most difficult to address of all of them. It now stands in a fiscal state not dissimilar to the Mediterranean countries or even Ireland, albeit that it has a much better ability to service its debt. Again, I'd probably suggest, at the risk of sounding like a naive patriot, that this is the end result of several decades of concerted economic absent-mindedness, as the British might themselves put it. There's another bit there where I wanted to talk about the British, about the Blair-Brown government's. I'll just say a few words, I think, for the sake of not wasting time. Certainly Tony Blair saw himself as a modernising leader, and I think one does have to give him that. He did attempt to modernise Britain in various ways. Britain's national self-image, he attempted to reform public institutions and indeed parts of the welfare state to be more consumer-focused, and I think you'd have to give him some of those points. Yet in other respects it was still politics as usual throughout the Blair period, and nothing really had changed, I think, in other elements of the political culture. British political parties, by our standards, I think, are still quite antiquated as institutions. And his own Labour Party, I think, managed to spend a large part of the last decade more or less oblivious to its steadily diminishing popular base. So now Labour is back in the same place it was in 1983 when people thought it was on the brink of ceasing to exist as a major political party, and they've not really done that much to address it in the meantime. I think it's also fair to say that Westminster politics is still more distant and secretive than in Australia, still true even today, and political and service delivery much more centralised and inscrutable. I have to say, not every aspect of a more centralised government system is good, it seems to me. We're presently in this country in a sense of wanting to abolish the states and how much better it would be just to have a national government and a local government. Some overseas experiences might seem to bear that out, not all of them. I'm not sure that Britain is a case in point. The level of centralisation and the effects it has on public debate and public openness, I think, have not always been good. Definitely Britain has moved on since the days of Yes Minister, but even today, I think, it's hard to imagine making a programme like that in this country. It wouldn't ring true in the way it does there. The same arrogance and insouciance of the public service elite, apparently with no sense of obligation to explain themselves to the public, doesn't quite work in our setting, it seems to me. Again, this might be naive patriotism on my part. Now, of course, we all have somewhere in the back of our minds a comforting fantasy that says that history is a kind of deity which passes wise judgments on events in retrospect, sorts out the saved from the damned, and gives a kind of tidy logic to events in retrospect. And, of course, yet I'm here as a trained historian to tell you, and I'm sure you know without me telling you, that history, in fact, does nothing of the sort. Chiefly, we use it to confirm our prejudices, settle scores, and explain how we got to be the kinds of interesting people we are today. Much more interesting than the people of the past, which is the purpose of history, to prove that. Of course. And so, as an historian, I never expect history to tell me what really happened or to illuminate what seemed obscure at the time. Although, of course, retrospect is an invaluable tool for all that. And yet, retrospect serves that purpose, but there are also historical moments that I think, in retrospect, when you look back on them, assume a new significance. And I think, in retrospect, 2010, like 1983, 84, 85, will seem like that in the modern political history of Britain. It stands, if you like, I have no idea why I wrote this sentence, but there you are, it's here. It stands, if you like, as an historical hen house in which a great many political chickens came home to roost at the same time. Did I really write that? Obviously I did. And then the next sentence is something about trying to read the entrails of the chickens. I'll just jump that all together. I'm sorry. Okay, so I'll cut to the chase, having given you that long sort of background there. Two points then I think worth making. The first point is, I think, if my analysis is not too partial and too myopic and patriotic, that Britain has been in a de facto non-two-party state now for a generation, but have been in denial about that, partly out of self-interest of the different political parties. At points it suited the Conservatives, more often it suited Labour, who's done best out of that situation, actually. But really, that's where they've been at. And you can argue the toss back and forth, and people more expert cephalogically than me could do it better than me, about how that would look if they had a different electoral system more like ours, if they had preferential voting such as we do. And they're now toying with the idea that, being British, of course, they can't say, like they do in Australia. Instead, they say, what is it, the single transferable vote, I think is what they want to call it, something like that. Which always reminds me, when I hear them saying that, of the days when they used to call the secret vote the Australian ballot. And the reason why you couldn't have the secret vote in Britain was that was the way they did it in Australia, which is so incredibly funny. But they're thinking about moving that way, as you might be aware, but only in the knowledge it's nothing to do with us. But you could ask yourself, would Britain be a three-party system now if they had preferential voting, such as we have in federal elections here? At least the state picture, of course, is muddier these days. And I don't know what the answer to that is. Maybe it would, ironically, have morphed to something being closer to a two-party system again, with the Liberal Democrats be more like the Democrats here or the Greens. I don't know. But nevertheless, out of history, that is what they've had for a generation de facto, except they have been in denial about it. So that's my first point, I think. And the second point would be, distinct point from that, really, that over that period of time there has been also a kind of willed blindness about the fragility of British public finances, which has been obscured by the great political turmoils of that period. You know, the great, even today, of course, people say in Britain say the word Thatcher's Britain, which of course summons up all the fires of hell, as if in that period Britain was completely remade. And from that you would expect the statistics would tell us all sorts of things went up and down, and unfortunately, on the whole, the statistics don't show that, with a few exceptions at all. On the whole, Britain was not perhaps transformed as dramatically over that period as we might imagine. And even still today, which I think was still obvious in the recent election campaign, Britain has still remained remarkably vague, not just about the state of its public finances and their robustness and how to reinforce them and make them sounder, but also how to communicate that and discuss that in public political debate. And it has really not happened in that country, I think it's fair to say, in any concerted way over any of the course of the last generation at all. And again, this is naive patriotism on my part, but when you compare the debates and the turmoil we've had in this country over that same period, think Paul Keating and the Banana Republic, or all those other things, it's a very striking difference between our anxieties, our concerns, our desperate desire. And, you know, remember, we all thought the country was going down the plug hole because of our current account deficit at one point. We kind of forgot that because it didn't seem to be so much the case. If anything, we worried too much rather than too little. Whereas in Britain, for whatever combination of historical factors, and it can't just be World War II, they clearly worried much too little. And I think a matter of equal concern that they have also not found a way to address it in public debate. And I think that was the thing about the 2010 election there, very strikingly from an Australian point of view. And here I'm diverging completely from my script, but to try and get more closely to the point. Britain faced the most dramatic economic events since World War II. It is in a fiscal position and potentially even other kinds of economic positions resembling the Great Depression, possibly, over the next few years. And yet there has been no serious attempt to address the underlying factors of that in public debate, and most of the British public have not been drawn into that knowledge in the way we would expect in this country. I think there's clearly a failure of public debate. It doesn't say something in a parochial sense about Britain, but about the perils, I think, of public debate in parliamentary democracies, even in the mother of them all. Okay, so 2 points I think that I want to make, and I'll cut to the chase because I've done the usual academic thing of rambling too long here. And you probably gathered them already, and that's the point of my digressions along the way. Firstly, that I think the two major problems with the British election this year, firstly, that the campaign was conducted in a fashion that still presumed that Britain was a two-party system, when it hasn't been for a generation. And the manner in which that was done gravely compromised the workings of representative democracy, I would suggest. It was a farcical election in that respect. Point one. I'll talk more about that in a second. Point two, in the context of the greatest fiscal and possibly even economic malaise of Britain since the Great Depression, almost equaling the Great Depression, there was no serious attempt, to articulate to the public the depths of that and what would be required. The same Institute for Fiscal Studies I mentioned a few minutes ago costed what the parties were saying would be needed between now and 2015 to address just the structural budget deficit of public finances in Britain, nothing else, not worrying about unemployment, and concluded that all the parties thought it was somewhere between about 45 and 65 billion English pounds. Then the Institute for Fiscal Studies looked at all of the statements made by all the parties up until the election day and what they were proposing to do, and varying according to the party, from memory, I think this is right in my head, I think unfortunately the Labor was the worst offender here. They had costed savings up to about 13% of the total of what they said would be necessary. 87% of what they presumably believed needed to be done, they weren't about to tell the British electorate. And the most virtuous were the Liberal Democrats, where I think it was slightly over, was around about a quarter. They had enumerated about a quarter of the cuts they said they thought would be necessary. But then theirs was the most optimistic picture of what would be needed, so maybe they weren't being so virtuous after all. But I would have thought, on both of those accounts, the British election of 2010 was a basic failure of democratic protocols and trust even in the electorate. It's very sad to say about the country that in a sense invented the system and in a sense invented our system as well. Just a few thoughts about that out of what remains, which goes on a bit too long for me to manage to get in before 1 o'clock. Just some obvious points about that. Firstly, the Liberal Democrats were widely described in the British election campaign and presented themselves, and still do, as a centre-left political party. Labour, of course, also presents itself as a centre-left political party. The Conservatives present as a centre-right political party, but moving more centrewards. The centre has become much more densely populated in British politics than it was a generation ago, that's for sure. And so I think it's fair to say that British voters going into the polling booths would have voted on those presumptions. None of the three parties at any point talked about what they might do after the election, even though I think it was manifestly obvious that no party was likely to get an electoral majority in their own right. It's extremely unlikely that was going to happen. Outside chance that the Conservatives might have done it, but very rare. None of the three parties said anything about what would happen in the overwhelmingly likely event that a coalition had to be formed. And so just to take the obvious example, anyone thinking of voting Liberal Democrat, a party presenting itself as a centre-left political party, had no idea whether in voting Liberal Democrat they were voting in a government of the left or, in fact, a government of the centre-right. There was no way of knowing that. And so, in fact, 25% of the British electorate, plus other people voting for minor parties, who got nowhere, of course, in their system at all, their votes were just lost, 25% of the British electorate voted in pure hope, with no knowledge whatsoever of what their vote would mean for the outcome of the election and which government would be formed, which I would have thought is simply a miscarriage of democracy, you know, in a moral sense, not in a technical sense, obviously, but in a moral sense. And likewise, even Labour and Conservative supporters had no idea what their parties were going to do after the election. No one would talk about it. And I would have thought that with a generation to think through this point, it should have been possible to imagine beforehand how you would speak to the electorate and take the electorate into your confidence about those issues. I hope that in a similar circumstance in this country, we would not go down that path. It's not immediately on the horizon. There is no third party immediately in the process of becoming big enough that that would become an issue. But if it did, then that obviously would be a problem. So that's point number one, I think. And obviously, I mean, it's hard to imagine what circumstances in this country that would approximate that. Once I came up with Liberals and the National Party refusing to campaign together, but then coming back into the coalition after the election. That might be a similar, but on a lesser scale. If Labour and the Greens campaigned separately, but then formed a joint government, I guess that would be a very paler version of the same sort of imposture, but on a much lesser scale, I think. It's hard to imagine this country a problem in the near future which would mirror that. But I think the basic principle is simple, obviously, that clearly the British electorate should have been taken into the confidence of the party leaders, and in a way that they weren't, clearly. And then, of course, even to make things more bizarre, after an election campaign in which Labour and the Liberal Democrats have both presented themselves as being centre-left political parties, neither, so far as we can tell, seriously engaged in talks with the other to form the centre-left government that most people assumed they would try and form. So even people's best guesses of what might happen were confounded, and they were given no hint otherwise. All the evidence that's come out, anecdotal evidence that's come out since the election campaign and gossipy evidence, has suggested that neither the Liberals nor the Liberal Democrats nor Labour seriously intended to form a coalition as a result of the election. So what it is the British electorate was supposed to make about that series of political events and how they should vote, I have no idea, I have to say. It's a travesty of a venerable and worthy electoral system. The second point is the point that I've already made, which is that there, as I've mentioned already, there was no serious effort to deal with the fiscal crisis in political terms or to explain in any serious way how it was going to be dealt with. And immediately after the election, the new Conservative Liberal Democratic government did exactly what you'd expect. They said, oh my goodness, things are so much worse than I thought. Said, even worse will be needed, and we might now tell you what that is. Clearly that was a failure of politics and democracy as well, I would have thought. And again, in terms of lessons for Australia, we have no immediate lessons of that magnitude, I think. I don't think we can think of a recent election or a recent crisis of that magnitude where the parties have failed to take the electorate into their confidence in that spectacular way, as in 2010 in Britain. However, I mean, I think the possibilities are there. I think, and I don't say this in a partisan point, to make a partisan point at all. But I think over the last couple of years, since the economic global economic crisis of 2008, out of a sense of the urgency of the times, clearly there were standards of public accountability and public disclosure to do with aspects of the stimulus program, which were troubling in that respect, I think I have to say, and a bit worrying in terms of not going down the path that Britain has of developing economic policy in secret and not taking the electorate into your confidence. And I don't want to turn that, and it's not meant to be a partisan political point, I should stress, but I do think there are signs there that we need to think about. I mean, certainly ever since the early 1980s, Australian federal governments, I think, have taken the electorate broadly into their confidence about our economic difficulties, and sometimes even exaggerated them, as in the case of Paul Keating and the Banana Republic. But the possibility is there, and maybe there are even some signs, that in times of what appears to be economic emergency, and in retrospect, maybe 2008, for us in Australia, was not really actually an economic emergency, that in times of economic emergency, governments might be tempted to do things without taking the electorate into their confidence or without providing costings that we would otherwise expect them to have done. For all this, to be frank, you probably got this idea already, watching the 2010 elections in Britain, it was hard not to be affected by a rather unscholarly and even complacent sense of patriotism, not only because of my uncomfortable memories of Pimm's number one cup and jellied eels, I didn't really take to either of them, I have to tell you, that the two nations Britain of yore bring to my mind, which was also the point, of course, of my opening reverie, I think, that even in 1984, 85, in the mid-80s, it was still possible for a visitor to see Britain in that sort of 19th century fashion. With our national ethos that we like to think of as being pragmatic problem-solving, our imagined national ethos, if you like, and what we like to believe is our general willingness to face political problems squarely, we would like to believe we've avoided most of the egregious problems that afflict British political culture today. And yet, observing the decidedly improvised and untidy populism that's already in place, it seems to me, in our own election process in 2010, which is not perhaps right at the moment up to our usual high standards, it might be useful to keep in mind the recent British experience as it were, as they would say in the Middle Ages, a memento mori, a remembrance of death, a reminder of what happens to democracy when simple respect for the intelligence of the electorate is lost.
David, we do have some time for questions. If you would like to ask a question, would you like to come to one of the microphones in the centre so that we can hear you throughout the room? But can I kick off by asking, why are Britons so indifferent about their electoral systems? Is it that the flat caps that you saw being worn in 1983 are very much a state of mind still, and the majority or a large proportion of Britons think that someone else will look after them? They don't have to be engaged. Why don't they demand electoral reform?
Well, it was an impressionistic paper, and I run the risk of being too impressionistic in what I said there as well. I mean, there's a more mundane explanation, I guess, would be interests, political interests. You could say that it has suited, as I said, the Labor and Conservative parties at different times to keep things as they are. And yet, ironically, at the end of it all, I mean, I think it is a bit of a case study. Sometimes doing the right thing for the long run, I don't think in 10 years' time, looking back, the British Labour Party will think they were as clever as they thought they were, because not addressing the problems of the electoral system in Britain and the manifest bad representation it's led to. Sorry, over the last generation, I've wandered away from the microphone. Lecturer's first bad habit. Sorry about that. I hope you could hear all of that. But in a sense, by not addressing those problems as they emerge, they possibly in the longer run have condemned themselves to a worse fate than they might otherwise have endured, I think. Because paradoxically, if Britain had moved towards what Gordon Brown was vaguely talking about over the last 12 months, which is a sort of watered-down approximation of our exhaustive preferential system, I would have thought the British electorate over that time could have got used to preferential voting and would not feel that they had to make a choice about which the centre-left party of the future was going to be if they have to make that choice. And if they do make that choice, it's entirely possible it may not be Labor. That was entirely possible in the 1983, after the 1983 election. A lot of people in the Labor Party at the time feared the party's extinction. It's not impossible it could happen again. I don't want to sound like some sort of, you know, freshly scrubbed baby in this respect, in my innocence, but, I mean, it could be one of those cases where you look back and think, maybe actually doing the right thing would have been the right thing. Maybe addressing the problem at the time, even though it seemed electorally expedient to Labor to keep a system that worked for them, might in the long run have served them better, because as their old historic base fell away and they were more reliant on more lukewarm support, it may have been actually that a system closer to ours would have suited them better. But they are now really reliant on strategic heartlands. If you look at the electoral map of Britain right now, look at, you can Google it, Wikipedia will give it to you. You look at the election results of Britain from 2010. Just go and have a look and you'll see what I mean. Virtually the entirety of England is Tory, with the exception of certain neighbourhoods around southeast England, and everything from north of the Midlands is Labour or Liberal Democrat. It's purely tribal in a sense, which is a result, I would say, of having failed to address some elementary problems of changing, of the needs for changes to the electoral system over a generation.
We'll have a question from you then, the gentleman in the front row.
Okay, thank you. Your statement at the end that the simple respect for the intelligence of the electorate is lost really resonated with me. Frankly, I see that here in Australia. I don't see our parliamentarians of any party really speaking to our better nature, and I find that a great tragedy. What can we, the electorate, do about that?
I have to confess, my expectations are lower than yours, I think. I know exactly what you mean, and I'm kind of with you there and kind of not. I mean, I am a believer in majoritarian politics, so I believe one has to find political solutions to things which are morally complex. And I don't believe we can expect better of our politicians than that, and if we do, we're probably expecting things they can't deliver. But I do think there's some level below which politicians shouldn't stoop and should be expected not to stoop, even if they don't incarnate our best natures, and as we might wish they did. At the very least, they shouldn't deceive us egregiously or leave us in the dark. They should give us choices that at least we understand. And then if people make the choices we think are the wrong ones, at least a choice was made. I think that for me, it's a lower level. I understand the problem you're alluding to. I think I'm talking about a much more mundane, lower level problem, which is not even politicians doing the right thing or following their hearts, but simply making it possible to understand what the options are, even if people choose what you or I might think is the wrong one.
Two brief examples, using asylum seekers as ping pong balls, and the wars in Iraq, where everybody was sort of being hairy-chested. I don't understand how that's talking to our better nature.
Well, I'd just say again what I said just then. I distinguish between two orders of problem there, a problem where you think, where you're angry that politicians you think are behaving in an immoral fashion, and my lower order problem, which is whether or not the politicians even present the choices on offer, even if you feel that people have made the wrong one.
Chris, my name is John Burge, and I'd like to call into question the point you made that the 2010 British elections proceeded on a two-party basis. And I'd like to do so in the context of the televised debates. So for the very first time that Britain had televised debates, all three leaders were represented, and that's something that would be unthinkable in Australia.
It wouldn't be unthinkable if we had a third party that was on track to become the second party. The Liberal Democrats, when those debates were held, were a serious possibility of polling more than Labor. And when that happens in this country, I would hope we do the same thing. No, and you're absolutely right, and of course I misspoke, and I would take your point entirely. The British election campaign of 2010 was conducted in certain respects as a three-party election campaign. Of course, that was so unbelievably novel and what blew everyone's socks off. If you were following the British newspapers, columnists, cynical columnists, were caught up in this. I remember one of my favourite English columnists, a bloke called David Aronovich, who writes for The Times, He just thought this was the most exciting election in history. I think just because somewhere in his mind he felt they were financially addressing the world that was there in terms of how people were intending to vote. And you're absolutely right, of course. It was presented for the first time as a three-party system. And yet the parties didn't behave that way, which is the simple point I was trying to make. They still behaved as if each of them was in a two-party system, which accidentally had a third party, if you know what I mean. And yet clearly what was going to be the outcome of the election was a coalition government. That was the overwhelming likelihood. And yet they still behaved in the two-party mentality that one of the three parties, talking as if one of the three parties would govern. So you're absolutely right, and I didn't express my point correctly, and you forced me to express it correctly, and thank you for that.
So we're going up to the gallery next, and then I've got three requests down on my left, which we'll come back to after we've been to the gallery.
Can you hear down there? This is what... There's a fourth party in the British system that you haven't mentioned.
Yes.
And that is the apathy party,
people
who don't vote. And the big difference between Australia and England is, of course, that in Australia we have compulsory voting, something which I think is absolutely brilliant, having come from England. And I wonder to what extent the lower vote, and is it dropping even so, the attendance at the polls in England, even more so? And that is a possibility in Australia too, given that we now have parties that are competing at the centre rather than being clearly defined as left or right.
Okay, thank
people
you.
Could become so pissed off, disillusioned with politics, that they will just not turn out to vote, even though we have compulsory voting.
Yeah. Now, I have to say, the political historian in me has to say, and this is something political science has, I think, have established as well as you can empirically, as far as I'm aware, there's no evidence that Australians are actually more disenchanted with politics now than they were a generation or two generations ago. But Australians were always cynical about politics. And we always want to believe we're getting more cynical. And of course, Australian political parties have always tended to cluster to the centre, and of course, most times they do in most countries, except usually in exceptional circumstances. But you're absolutely right that something that distinguishes not Britain but us is compulsory voting, or at least compulsory attendance at elections. We're not forced to vote, of course. But, it's possible to argue that point in law, I suppose. But compulsory attendance at polling booths, at the very least. Of course, that is our peculiarity rather than the British. I'm ashamed to confess, I can't actually remember what the turnout was in 2010 in Britain. I do remember that people were disappointed, that they expected all the excitement of the new three-party debates and all that would make the turnout higher than it was, but I can't remember what it was. But certainly, in a lot of Western countries, there has been a slow decline in participation, spectacularly in America, we know, over the last couple of generations. There's been a slight decline in Australia as well, of more people being fined for not turning up to polling booths, but we don't exactly know why that is. That might be apathy, it might just be busyness, who knows. And of course, people in Australia have argued for the longest time as to whether our system is better or worse, but certainly what we do know is it's more representative. And to take your point another way, I suppose the most egregious thing about the British system in that respect is if you have a first-past-the-post system without preferences, and without our system of compulsory voting, of course, that does mean that, in effect, Margaret Thatcher believed she was remaking Britain on 42% of the vote of about 70% of the population. And, in fact, the legitimacy of governments, by our standards, becomes, kind of in a sense, absurd. I would have thought you put those two things together, yes, and you have a major problem. The first-past-the-post system, I think, is antiquated and they should get rid of it. You put it together with voluntary voting and, the legitimacy of ballots starts to look shaky.
Gentleman in the second row, followed by the gentleman in the third row.
First of all, I'd like to declare that perhaps you may think I have a British impediment, but I can assure you it's not an upper-class British impediment.
It wasn't my joke. That was Raymond Williams' joke. It was a Welsh professor's joke at the expense of the English.
I'm going to add to that by saying that I'm a dual national, UK and France, And I have voted in three countries as a result of that. First in UK, in Australia in the 1950s, before I was disenfranchised by being out of the country in 1985, and of course in France. Now, what I would like to ask you is what do you think for the UK, and perhaps also for Australia, but what do you think is the best electoral system? Because the Liberal Democrats want proportional representation. Having seen what havoc that created in France in the Fourth Republic with unstable governments, I don't think it's a good idea at all. And nobody, of course, perhaps for the same reason you're suggesting that they won't copy Australia in the UK, nobody thinks of copying the French system of constituencies with two rounds of voting. As you know, it is said in France that in the first round you vote with your heart, in the second with your wallet. Perhaps you'd like to say what you think.
Yeah, sure. Well, it'll have to be brief, of course, because we're running out of time, but it's a good question. I confessed five or six times here to naive patriotism today already, and here's the seventh. You know, I actually think our system works well. It's not flawless, of course. We know in all sorts of ways minor parties often feel quite annoyed about it, feel they're underrepresented, and minor parties in Australia nearly always think PR, with proportional representation, would be better. On the other hand, of course, minor parties like the Greens sometimes get to enjoy themselves and run the prospect of winning seats like Melbourne or Melbourne Ports or Sydney with far less than 50% of the popular vote, not even coming close to coming first in the electorate. So occasionally they get their moment in the sun as well, and it would be a very big moment in the sun, and maybe even a bit of a minor travesty of democracy when it happens, but nevertheless. So we have our aberrations in our system going both ways, both to the disadvantage and to the advantage of minor parties, but they're nothing compared with first past the post. Of course, you'll be aware that in Italy, after the great corruption scandals of the 80s there and the Christian Democrat hegemony collapsing, they were so disillusioned with PR, proportional representation, regarding it basically as a mechanism for corruption, which it sometimes is, that they then borrowed the British system, or thought that's what they were doing. out of the frying pan into the fire, I guess you could say. But I think PR does have the problems you've mentioned by itself. And some hybrid system, often it's one of those things where hybrid systems are often better than pure systems. Our system is really a hybrid. And as you say, the French is another effort at a hybrid. Hybrid electoral systems often work quite well.
Gentlemen in the third row, and if it's a short question and answer, we might just have time to squeeze in one last one.
Thank you for an excellent and entertaining talk. I wonder if you'd comment on the actual mechanics of the voting process, because the failure of the first-past-the-post system is a fairly obvious thing, even on a superficial reading. I was astounded. I was astounded at some of the mechanics, where one person has to check the roll-off in each polling booth. There's only one person instead of half a dozen as we have here, and enormous queues, the day, voting on a working day, and apparently not enough papers in some electorates. I mean, how could they be so administratively incompetent when you compare the efficiency of the AEC?
Well, I don't know how the AEC does that. I have to say, having lived in a number of countries over the years, I don't know how they do it. They're brilliant. And I have no idea how, unlike almost every country in the Western world, using a purely mechanical, analogue, non-digital system of voting, we can know what happened in federal elections across an entire country in an hour and a half. In other countries of a similar level of affluence and political sophistication, it can take days to find the same answer. It's just a tribute to the AEC. So there's my ninth bit of naive patriotism for the day. I suppose to be fair to them, you'd have to say that in a country, which is every country in the Western world but us, where voting, or at least attendance, is not compulsory, the question of how many ballot papers to print is slightly more vexed. Obviously in an era of constraint on paper usage as well. But yes, I mean, you're hinting at, I think, an element of antiquatedness there that might be specifically British, and there might be that as well. But certainly, yeah, I mean, our Australian Electoral Commission is a model, I think, or ought to be a model. Not that I'm not aware of anyone else in the world coming to see how it does it, but I don't know how we managed to do it. I mean, having been in all aspects of the polling process myself in different parts of my life, working as a young person in there, having scrutineered in the past and all sorts of things, I mean, it's pretty impressive.
I know there are lots more questions, but unfortunately our time is up, so I'm going to draw the formal proceedings to a close, but if you'd like to come up and just quickly ask David after the lecture, I'm sure we can hang around for a couple of minutes to satisfy those requests. But it's been a fabulous lecture. Thank you very much for coming to us today. And thank you to our very faithful audience for attending on a cold day. See you next time.